Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So before we leave the historical context, I have to ask you about your grandma. Again, we're sitting in Graham's kitchen, and I'm looking at this really rather poignant and very well executed art piece that depicts a nude woman. And I can't stop staring at it. And I know that your grandma came up a few times throughout the interview, but I want you to tell us about her. I get a strong sense that she was an influence in your life of formidable proportions.
Absolutely. I specifically remember when my father and everyone else was not very interested in us being in the wine business, grandma was sitting on the porch and turned and said, and she'd continue this throughout our young lives, he said, "It would be my dream if someday you guys had made a wine from our property." And she died at 97, and we got to taste her on our first vintage before that happened. And so she's been incredibly valuable. She was the encouragement behind what we are doing, and everything we do is to honor her and the rest of the family. And she was so powerful because when my granddad was alive, he was obsessed with the vineyard. It was fun. When I was interviewing people at Mondavi's Winery, they said that Bob used to call him the best grape grower in the Napa Valley.
Wow.
Because back then, nobody cared about what a vineyard looked like, and everything was bottom line, making the money that you could off of it. And he would go out there and make sure every vine was in place. Nothing was dead. Everything looked right. And so I feel like that was an incredible thing. And so he had a stroke, and my grandmother had to take over. And so she really managed the property with Bob Mondavi for about 20 years, making sure that things were in. Good decisions were being made, and I'm so grateful because we have a block in our vineyard planted by every generation of the family, and it just creates that was protected. If someone else had been in charge and decided to change the direction or rip out the old vines, which has been a constant theme in our history as a vineyard manager, saying, "Oh, you should take those out and you'll make more money doing this," we wouldn't have some of the oldest vines in the valley.
That kind of wisdom, really, it's priceless, it's instructive, it's something that's an underlying theme behind what you do. Let's talk about the vineyard. I had the pleasure of walking it a few years back, and I was quite impacted emotionally. And it was spontaneous. I didn't want to be a crybaby, but I found myself so impacted, just the visual alone. And you showed me the old vine block, and you named the vines. It is, it's not just a vineyard. It really is a major part of your world. It's like a family member. Tell us about your relationship with the vineyard.
Yeah, for me, these being able to prune the vines that were planted by my great-grandparents and grandparents, it's my connection to them. Yeah. I knew my grandfather, I knew my grandmother, but I didn't know my great-grandparents. So they have a little block. It's planted in the mid-50s, and it's each vine is completely unique, as we were talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's one that I call Arnold Schwarzenegger, because it's just all muscles and arms, and probably produces most of the juice in the block. But it's, they're so unique. It's kind of, in many ways, like people as they age, they just get more and more. They don't care what people think. They're going to be themselves. And I feel like the connection to the vineyard is so strong because my granddad loved it, and you could barely tear him away from being out there. And I do feel like, to me, that's more connected to nature. The winemaking process is more of guiding it just to the finish. But I equate it to, like, you're raising your kids, and then as a grower, you send them off to college and you never see them again. And I couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know my grandparents managed to, but emotionally I had to follow through and see how they'd turn out. And so everything for me is vineyard related, and the winemaking, if anything, it's more about what I don't have to do, or thinking through things so I don't have to be in a position to be in trouble. one of the best lessons at Davis. I'm one of the quickest people to repeat John Konsgaard that we had to, as you leave Davis, you have to forget 95% of what you learned. Otherwise, you're going to really struggle to make great wine. One of the things that I was taught is not to be, not to have a reactionary response. You have to think it through and try to come up with a solution of why this happened, and then you can learn from that. And that's where, again, Scolium was so powerful, because we got to learn what happens when you push wine beyond and get into flavor ranges that you wouldn't necessarily be comfortable with. And so being able to see that makes you realize what causes it. So we're always trying to understand the root of, and for me, that with winemaking, that is the vineyard. I mean, so much of what you're given is depending on how you treated the vines, how the weather treated the vines, and everything that you do in the vineyard is sort of like a gentle touch, as where in wine, if you add something to the wine or you do some sort of manipulation, it makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. So I love that the vineyard sort of muffles the human interaction.
Wow. It's a small vineyard. Mm-hmm. What is the size of it?
So it's 15 acres planted.
And the oldest vine block is?
So yeah, mid-50s. Planted by our great grandparents. Yeah. Then my grandfather has a very large block for an old vine block that's about 7.5 acres, planted in 1974. And then there's a 6.4 acres from the mid 90s that Bob Mondavi planted for mm-hmm. the family. Mm-hmm. And then my brother and I planted our generations block, which is about 0.5 acre right here next to the cottage. Mm-hmm. And it's probably the least interesting blocks. It's right next to the creek and shaded with trees and competing to survive. But I took about 2 years planning it, because mm-hmm. I knew this was my one shot in my lifetime to do this. And the amazing thing is, so we ended up planting in the same style called California Sprawl, which my great grandparents did. So okay. After everything I've learned, everything I've seen, I came back to realizing that was the best way to express the site, mm-hmm. Because the canopies are like the bush vines, so mm-hmm. they naturally sprawl. Mm-hmm. So in regards to manipulation, you're not tucking the shoots into a position where what happens is the hormones, if they're tucked as a vine's climbing a tree, tells it to keep growing up, because mm-hmm. it's got to get to the top before it spreads out. So it's a more natural growth habit, and then it also protects it from the sun. And so the leaves droop and shade the fruit so that you don't get sunburn and flavors that are not as pure Cabernet as we're looking for.
Wow. You're quite a vine whisperer. As I listen to you, I'm picturing in my mind, it's so alive. And I feel the urge to thank you for such a thoughtful approach, because I think if we're all more thoughtful about what we do, this world would be very different. What was your toughest vintage? What was there such a thing? And if so, what were the hardest parts about it?
It's a good question. I'd say the way I approach vintages is I love variation. I love the fact that it's not Coca-Cola, that we get something different every year. And every year you have to make a strong decision, coming back to the comments about taking risks. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, because the vintages that are the ones that are panned critically in the Napa Valley are the least exciting, or always my favorite, because you have to prove that great sites can make great wines in off vintages, and then you also have to make stronger decisions. I remember one of my first triumphs was in 2011. It was a cool year. There were rains. Things weren't getting as ripe as normal, and I called a friend who I'd worked with on an internship, whose family has a place in Pomerol, and I explained the situation and the vintage, and he emailed back. He said, "Oh my God, Graham, if this was the weather we were having in Pomerol this year, it would be one of the great vintages of the century." And so, what we decided to do is instead of pushing the fruit beyond the curtain closing for nature, we decided to make wines that honored our grandparents, because when they were making home wines back in the 70s with the family and the cousins, this was how they made them at these ripeness levels. And so we made this wine that was stylistically different than the previous wine, but it began sort of a tradition of honoring the vintage and not trying to make something that's it doesn't have to be consistent, it has to be reflective.
Yes, and there's I've had the privilege of tasting through the vintages, which is rarefied, and I can say that the integrity factor is really paramount. It shows up, you know, way beyond the tasting notes. It sets the bar so high. I always kind of half complain that it's hard to taste other wines after yours, because it is such a revelation in what wasn't done. Not exerting your formidable knowledge and experience. But it's that poster child for less is more. It really is about the land. And you can talk about it, but the way it shows up is pretty rare to achieve.
Yeah, I've been lucky. I read one of my favorite books. Is a philosophical one called The One Straw Revolution. It's about a Japanese rice and citrus farmer. It's about do-nothing farming. So it's like, what's the minimum you can do to get away with making the crop? And then what that to me is, that's a closer relation to the expressing the purity of the site. And one of the analogies that makes sense to me is, we grew up walking our creek and picking wild blackberries and strawberries and eating those, and there's a vitality in the naturally grown fruit that is something I desire to make in the vineyard. It's this freshness, it's this sort of sensation of mouth-watering, where it's not, we're not eating dessert, we're not feeling heavy, we're feeling like fresh and invigorated. And I feel like if you can capture that freshness and purity in the wine, then you've really done something special. And in my experience, the way you do that is being very careful not to have to hit it with a hammer. Mm-hmm. It's all about guidance, and it's all about letting things express themselves.
We spoke briefly before the interview about this transference of the land and how it influences you every moment of every day. And I kind of refer to it as a hefty dosage of sanity when I stand here and take it in and just let it embrace me. What is it like living in this environment and raising family and being so intimately, intensely connected?
To me, it's so powerful. It's what I want my daughters to connect to. And in regards to continuing a legacy, it's very strategic about not forcing it on. The last thing I want is to hand my daughters something and ask them to maintain it. My entire goal is to let them connect and enjoy it. And then hopefully that the passion for here, which they already have, will be fostered. For me, I feel like the power of being here and living on the property is being able to be in nature and see it. I mean, I'm just constantly in awe of walking the vineyard and having this effect of a rainforest with ladybugs on the cover crops and worms in the soil and gophers eating all sorts of things. It's really, really a very living land. And it's very powerful to me too, because when I was younger, we haven't sprayed Roundup on the property in our lifetime, but they were doing conventional sprays, which are synthetic things for mildew. And I was out there on the tractor doing these, and I came into my wife covered in this stuff, feeling like, what am I doing? This doesn't make sense for the land. And so when I took over farming in 2012, we were converted to 100% organic. And I feel like it's interesting to walk from you can walk across a boundary in our vineyard where you go from our blocks, which are like a rainforest, and you can go to the moon, where someone's spraying Roundup. It's conventionally farmed. So it's been really helpful for me to see what I relate to. And also, there's so many more risks farming naturally than there are farming conventionally. And I feel like that's been really important to be able to see. I think if you just learn about it, everything's sort of put in the same category, or some things that you do organically or biodynamically can be considered a little bit too crazy or voodoo. And it's really important to experience it and then determine your own path from there.
Yeah, and it's really, you're driven by what's good for the land, what's good for the vineyard. It's not, you know, for the sake of the practice.
And by living here, you you're more intimately connected. If your neighbor is spraying a chemical and it's a big cloud blowing into your mm-hmm. into your house, which has happened to me, mm-hmm. It's you understand. You say this affects people. It's not somewhere I drive to work and then I drive home and I don't have to see what people do in the evenings or the nighttime. So it's an incredible opportunity to fully immerse and then realize what feels right and what feels wrong.
So taking a step back and kind of assessing Oakville and Napa Valley in general, you described as a highly responsible, very conscientious approach, this true steward approach to the land. How do you think that truly sustainable, not just as a word, but as a deed yeah. approach, how can it be propagated in a positive way so that, we preserve this incredible treasure?
Yeah, my dream and sort of we want to lead by example, and I feel like if people can make the connection between how we farm and why the wines have that vitality or freshness or mm-hmm. some ethereal quality, I think that sets the bar for mm-hmm. other people to consider doing the same. And sustainability is, it's such a good word, yet it's so adulterated by everything can be sustainable. And so yeah. as where I appreciate people stepping in that direction, seeing land that's deprived and lacking life versus areas that are full of life are mm-hmm. just, it's such a powerful thing. And I feel like everyone should have that experience if they're lucky enough to just realize that what we do to our properties can have incredible effects down the road. And so because we're thinking hundreds of years and generations, everything I do is about not pissing the grandchildren off. And so I don't want to make a mistake or spray DDT or something crazy in our vineyard and then have generations later saying, oh, well, I wish granddad hadn't done that. So it's all has to be natural. It all has to, with our block that we planted, it's all natural cedar and redwood. So all the posts, even the metal I'm worried about is I don't yeah. want something that was manufactured abroad to come in the ground and leach iron or other impurities. So we want everything to turn back into organic matter.
Wow. So taking a seat of the consumer for a moment, that's curious about wine, interested, hears all the marketing speak, all the buzzwords, and of course they want to support the things that I write. That's typically what people want to do. Do you have any advice how one can navigate their way when they have a desire to get to know, important wines from Napa Valley or just Napa Valley in general, and how they can allocate their resources properly?
I think the biggest thing for me is to pursue people that are small. I think in many cases there are definitely exceptions, but corporate wineries have a hard time taking risks. And so if organic viticulture is a risk, mm-hmm. if less conservative, more natural winemaking is a risk. So I think supporting small farms is important, especially in Napa Valley right now where things are getting gobbled up and the family farmer is more of a rarity. And then I think people that farm their properties and believe in philosophy and pursue things. I've had such a fun time. One of my friends, Rory Williams, whose family has Frog's Leap Winery, it's mm-hmm. seen what his dad did in the 70s, and he started this sort of movement for organics when it was very unpopular at the time. And just to see those things succeed give me such great joy, because I feel like in my mind, everyone can make the wine different, and I think that's what makes the valley great, is there's mm-hmm. so many different styles. But farming respectfully is something that I think everyone can do and everyone should do, because the better we treat our land, the more we're treasuring it, and the better the next generation will have it.
And speaking of next generation, you kind of, there's sprinkles throughout conversation with people like Alex and Rory. Clearly there's that next generational awareness and maybe even push to create that, precedent where we're not just doing things the way that our, parents did, and really demonstrate that this can be treated sustainably and this is a generational approach in the true sense of the word.
Absolutely. And the most exciting thing in their cases, since our family started with the vineyard. And so me and my brother have had the first generation of building, which is a very exciting time to create a winery and build a product. And theirs is interesting because they're second generation or even longer in the Consgard's case. And so it's a very interesting thing and very rewarding to see that transition happen successfully, and for the next generation to have the same passion is really, really exciting for me. And I feel like that movement, there's dozens of other friends who are doing similar things, but it's like this flame in the valley where it just feels like you're part of something exciting, which in my grandparents remembering their stories, that was always how they described Bob Mondavi. As they said, we felt like selling grapes to him, we were part of something. There was this excitement in the air, and I think Grandma said he was kind of like a rocket ship that you held on to and blasted off. And I feel like that's what I hope will happen with this next generation. Is there's Napa Valley is not just a focus of big marketing, but it's like got all these little pockets for everyone. So if you want a wine that's coming off of a minuscule vineyard and making a tiny amount, there's so much opportunity. And that's part of what's fun about wine is learning and pursuing and trying to figure out where those are.
Yes. So the teachable moment here is that don't take some flippant statements at face value that Napa Valley is about this or that. Find out for yourself. And there's ways to find people like you. And, you know, not only possibly get the wine we'll talk about in a minute, but really participate in that mentality that is so soothing and so healthy in so many respects and so uplifting. Just being here makes you feel like you're human, that you're not just caught up in the rat race, that there's something more to life. You feel connected, and it's so prevalent here. I've been coming here for decades and I never get tired of it. It's never the same. So I hope that you guys take those words to heart and really seek it out. Let's go back to 2010, because that's your first commercial release. And I know that your journey has been, it started a little rocky, but it became this flourishing brand that's very highly sought after. Tell us a bit about that.
That was an exciting, our first release was an exciting morning. So we put everything, the first thing that happened was 2 days before we were going to release, we got a call from a critic, which was Antonio Galloni.
Oh my.
And that was a hard thing for me, being so stressed out about the release. But all my mentors have said, when the critic calls, you do whatever you can. You're in such a lucky position that they want to learn more. And so he was sitting right where you sat, and we tasted him on the wine, and I didn't know at the time how to manage these things, so I kept asking him, what do you think of the wine? And he, I think you don't usually do that. They go home and they write and say something. And so eventually he told me, he said, I've never had anything like this.
And, wow, those are fighting words.
Yeah, and I thought that could either go really good or really bad. But when he was leaving, he said, please sign me up for your mailing list. I'd love to get some of this. And it's, we've just been so lucky that people like him and again, consumers have just been willing to tell other people about it, because our philosophy was whenever we buy wine, it's because our friends tell us, this is something exciting, this is something fun. And so for something so small and delicate as us, is having people that are willing to be part of it and tell other people and spread the word has been our bread and butter. And it's not just critical or big industry people, it's every consumer that opens it at a table with a friend, which is what I love about it. And so we've connected with all these people that have become friends that are buying our wine, and it's just, I never imagined how social and exciting it would be to share wine. And so the first release was rough on us, because we were getting ready to sell the wine, and we had a little bit of a list that came through the internet, and we had no idea who was going to buy the wine, or based on all the commentary, we weren't very optimistic. And so I was sitting in my little secretary's desk here on my computer at 9 a.m. with, my brother was in Mississippi at the time, and so he's on his computer set up to deal with the first release, and in the first minute, 10 people ordered. And I thought, oh my God, this is so exciting. 10 people were waiting. this is couldn't get better. And then the next minute, 20 people ordered, and the third minute, 30. And so in 20 minutes, our first vintage was entirely gone. And
my goodness, how about that?
And then looking at the e-commerce site, it just kept going down below into our personal inventory, which we were trying to save for the children. And so I'm calling my brother saying, oh my God, something's going wrong. And what it turned out to be is if you put it in your shopping cart, you could still check out.
Sure.
And so I'm calling him and I'm saying, do something. So he crashes the site, and I say, well, what's happening? And then by the end of the day, he had 600 angry emails. And I told him, I said, all right, well, email and call every single person back. Make sure that everyone knows how much we appreciate the interest. We'll do our best and share wine with them eventually. And then I went down to the cellar at 9:30 in the morning, popped a bottle of Schramsberg, and had a great rest of the day.
Oh my God, what a phenomenal story. So this pattern most likely have continued in the subsequent vintages, hasn't it? You have way more demand than supply. I know that you make, what, 200-300 cases?
Yep, yeah.
So it's really, really small. But I know you've tried to be really fair. So for those that are listening, waiting list perhaps is a good way to go.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where the goal is to share the wine with everyone. We're not trying to be exclusive in any way, and so we sell small little, usually three bottles, just enough to to spread it out as much as possible. But we're selling a couple restaurants and just sort of learning about that, and we're only making enough wine that I make all the wine with my own hands. There's mm-hmm. no mm-hmm. employees. There's just me and my brother, and when we're processing it up at Konsgard, they invited us up to be part of their winery. Mm-hmm. We're in the kids' corner, as John calls it. But yeah, when we're bringing in fruit and we're sorting it, it's me, my brother, my mom, my daughters, my wife. We're the sorting team,
my goodness.
So it's just a very pure familial thing, and that's why it's small. It's not small because we're trying to be exclusive. We're small because I can only do what I can do with my own hands, and that's so important to me.
What a incredibly heartwarming. Again, I have this picture in my mind of a true family affair. You're the embodiment of a family winery. Because obviously you have options. You could buy fruit, you could do other things, but you choose deliberately to stay small.
Yeah, and I think that's refreshing. There's such a mentality of growth in the Valley, and being so intimately connected with the Mondavis over all these years, I've seen, and Bob's personality, it's funny, I call him Bob because everyone calls him Mr. Mondavi, but I was interviewing Margaret, his wife, at one point, just trying to get some back history on our family and the relationship.
Sure.
And she said, he always wanted, I apologize because I should be calling him Mr. Mondavi, but my grandparents always called him Bob, and that's all I know what to do. And she said, he always wanted to be called Bob, and everybody called him Mr. Mondavi. So, yeah, but to see, he was such a ambitious and driving force, and he was always growing and expanding, and I think that's what made it so successful with taking all those risks. But I'm also trying to keep an idea that, not so for economical purposes, like we're hoping to be economical, but I want the next generation to have something to do. I don't want to make all the wine from the property, control everything, and then hand it to them and ask them to maintain it. I want to leave something for them to do. And so if me and my brother can make a life making wine with our own hands, I think that's an incredible accomplishment. And then when my daughters grow up, and if he has kids, if they grow into it too, then they can all decide on what the next step is. But we don't need to decide that for them.
Wow. So the future of McDonald's, the way that you see it, is what it is now. It really doesn't look that much different.
Yeah, I mean, I see it growing. I'm most excited about the day where the children tell me to go sit down and they're going to take over. Whenever that comes, I think that's the true sense of passing it on. And usually what happens is they send the old guys to the vineyard, which will be perfect. They'll put me out to pasture and I'll farm or do whatever they ask. But yeah, I feel like the pivotal thing is leaving room for them to do what they're passionate about, and maybe the stylistically they're saying, oh dad, your wines are too austere or backward, which is just my personality too, so it has to match who you are, and I feel like that's what's going to make it exciting. So I couldn't say specifically what direction it'll go. I just want to put it in a position where the purity and the philosophy is something that they appreciate and also believe in.
I've believed for many years, and thank you for validating that wines resemble their makers. I know it's grown in the vineyard, but it's crafted in the cellar. And I don't think your wines are austere for what it's worth. I think they're old soul.
Yeah.
There's an elegance and a wisdom to your wines.
Thank you.
And, you know, what's instructive about what you just described is that having that opportunity to be the ultimate steward and being able to pass it on and not forcing anything, but in fact really just embracing the gift, is something we could all learn from a great deal. We tend to exert control, and you have demonstrated with every word in this conversation how special it is not to. And I know you've been doing a tremendous amount of historical work and interviewing. I'm hoping it will turn into a book, perhaps. Yeah, or
that's the hope, yes.
Yes, I think that would be wonderful, because, again, we could all use a big dollop of such wisdom.
Yeah, and capturing that in words, as we were talking about earlier, is such a challenge. But yes, yeah. In the meantime, I've just been accepted as a Historic American Landscape Survey, which is part of the National Park Service.
Congratulations.
I wrote about 40 pages of the history of Tokalon. It's the first ever mm-hmm. real official documentation. So mm-hmm. we're talking about the true history. And so that's been really fun. And then I'm working on a National Register nomination. And then the book will be a more, those are so technically historical and cited and everything, which is great. But the book in my mind is really about the people and the passion and the connection to the land. And so there's so much of a deeper connection that I'd like to convey, which is that ethereal aspect of what it means to be farming here.
Well, this has been a great conversation, and the moral of this wonderful story is that you were presented with an opportunity that's quite unique, but how you handled it and how you've expressed your own personality and who you are fundamentally is really quite, you know, a pleasure to even listen to. You know, being around you, just being in the space by osmosis, it communicates the true value of what it's like to be handed a gift and how to add value to it. And there's such significance, I think, as a human being, to try to seek that. So my hope for the listeners is that should they get their hands on a bottle of your wine, or even just hearing the story, this is a story of lifelong friendships, of commitment, of dedication, self-awareness, goodwill, all timeless values. So for that, I thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.